old and... no, corruption was too melodramatic a word. Anyway, the strongly aromatic citral seemed to help. Just as Guthwulf had climbed to his feet, deserting the stool to resume the frustrated pacing that had occupied most of his waiting time, the throne room door creaked and swung inward. Priorati's blunt head appeared in the gap, black eyes flat and shiny as a lizard's.
Ah, good Utanit,
Priorati showed his teeth.
How long we have kept you waiting. The king is ready to see you now.
The priest pulled the door farther in, revealing his scarlet robe and a glimpse of the high hall behind.
Please, he said.
Guthwulf had to pass very close to Priorati's as he entered, sucking in his chest to minimize the contact. Why was the man standing so close? Was it to make Guthwulf uncomfortable? There was no love lost between King's Hand and the King's Counselor. Or was he trying to keep the door as nearly shut as he possibly could? The castle was cold this spring, and if anyone deserved to keep warm, it was Elias. Perhaps Priorati's was only trying to conserve heat in the spacious throne room. Well, if that was what he was up to, he had failed utterly. The moment Guthwulf stepped over the threshold and passed the door, he felt the chill descend upon him, turning the skin on his strong arms into chicken flesh. Looking past the throne, he saw that several of the upper windows were open, propped with sticks. The cold northern air that swirled down tugged at the torch flames, making them dance in their cressets.
Guthwulf,
Elias boomed, half rising from his chair of yellowed bone. The massive dragon skull leered over his shoulder.
I'm ashamed to have kept you waiting. Come here.
Guthwulf strode forward up the tiled walkway, trying not to shiver.
You have much on your mind, Majesty. I do not mind waiting.
Elias sat back in his throne as the Earl of Utanit dropped to a knee before him. The king wore a black shirt trimmed with green and silver, and his boots and breeks were also black. The iron crown of Fingil sat high on his pale brow, and in a sheath at his side was the sword with the strange crossed hilt. He had not been without it in weeks. But Guthwulf had no idea whence it came. The king had never mentioned it, and there was something queer and unsettling about the blade that prevented Guthwulf from asking.
Do not mind waiting, Elias smirked. Go on, sit down.
The king indicated a bench a pace or two back of where the earl kneeled.
Since when do you not mind waiting, Wulf? Just because I am king, do not think I have gone blind and stupid as well.
I am sure that when you have something for your king's hand to do, you will inform me.
Things had changed between Guthwulf and his old friend Elias, and the Earl of Utanit did not like that. Elias had never been secretive, but now Guthwulf felt vast, hidden currents moving beneath the surface of daily events, currents that the king pretended did not even exist. Things had changed, and Guthwulf felt sure he knew who was to blame. He looked past the king's shoulder at Priorati's, who was watching him fixedly. When their eyes met, the red-robed priest lifted a hairless eyebrow, as if in mocking question. Elias rubbed at his temples for a moment.
You will have work enough, and more soon, I promise you. Ah, my head, a crown is indeed a heavy thing, friend. I sometimes wish I could lay it down and go off somewhere, like we once did so often. Free companions of the road.
The king turned his grim smile from Guthwulf to his counselor.
Priest? My head aches again. Bring me some wine, will you?
At once, my lord.
Priorati's moved off to the back of the throne room.
Where are your pages, Majesty?
Guthwulf asked. The king looked dreadfully tired, he thought. The whiskers on his unshaven cheeks stood out, black against his wan skin.
And why, with respect, are you shut up in this freezing cave of a hall?
It is colder than the devil's black ass in here, and smells of mildew beside. Let me light a fire in the grate.
No. Elias waved a broad hand dismissively. I don't want it any warmer. I'm warm already. Priorates says it is just an ague. Whatever it is, the cool air feels good to me. And there is plenty of breeze, so no need to fear stagnancy or bad humors.
Priorates had returned with the king's goblet. Elias drained it with a swallow and dried his lips with his sleeve. Plenty of breeze indeed, Majesty, Guthwulf grinned sourly. Well, my king, you and Priorates know best, and doubtless have nothing to learn from a fighting man. Is there some other way I can serve you?
I think perhaps you can, although the task may not be much to your liking. First, though, tell me, has Elfengbald returned?
Guthwulf nodded. I spoke with him this morning, sire.
I have summoned him.
Elias held out his cup for more wine, and Priorates brought the ewer and poured.
But since you have seen him, tell me now, is his news good?
I am afraid not, sire. The spy you seek, Morgaini's henchman, is still at large.
God's curses!
Elias rubbed at a spot just beside his eyebrow.
Did he not have the hounds I gave him, and the master huntsman?
Yes, Majesty, and he left them still on the hunt. But in fairness to Fengbold, I must say that you have set him a nearly impossible task. Elias narrowed his eyes, staring, and for a moment Guthwulf felt he faced a stranger. Then the bumping of ewer against goblet broke the tension, and Elias relaxed.
Well-a-day, he said. You are most likely right. I shall have to be careful not to take any frustrations out on Fengbold. He and I share a disappointment.
Guthwulf nodded, watching the king. Yes, sire. I was alarmed to hear of your daughter's illness. How is Miriamel? The king looked briefly to Priorates, who finished pouring and backed away.
It is kind of you to ask, Wolf. We do not think she is in any danger, but Priorates feel sure that the sea air of Meramund will be the best remedy for her ailments. It is a pity to put off the marriage, though.
The king stared into his wine cup, as though it were the mouth of a well, down which he had just dropped something valuable. The wind whistled in the open windows. After some long moments had passed, the Earl of Utanyit felt compelled to speak. You said that there was some small task I could do for you, my king. Elias looked up.
Ah, of course. I wish you to go to Hernisadark. Since I was forced to raise the taxes to make up for the cursed, miserable drought, that old hill gopher, Luth, has defied me. He sent that prancing Eolair to soothe me with honeyed words. But the time for words is over.
Over, my lord? Guthwulf raised an eyebrow.
Over, Elias growled. I wish you to take a dozen knights. Any more, and Luth would have no choice but to resist. And hie you to the Teig to beard the old miser in his den. Tell him to refuse me my rightful due is to slap my face, to spit on the very dragon-bone chair. But be subtle. Say nothing in front of his knights that will shame him into resistance. Nevertheless, make it clear that to deny me further will risk his walls falling in flames about his head. Make him fear, Guthwulf.
I can do that, lord.
Elias smiled tightly. Good. And while you're there, keep an eye open for any sign of Joshua's whereabouts. There is no news from Naglamund, though my spies have it ringed round. It is possible my treacherous brother might have gone to Luth. It may even be he who is fueling Hernestia's obstinance.
I will be your eye as well as your hand, my king.
If I may, King Elias,
At the king's elbow, Priorates lifted a finger.
Speak, priest.
I would also like to suggest that our lord of Utanit keep an eye out for the boy, Morgani's spy. It would help to supplement Fangbald's effort. We need that boy, Majesty. What good to slay the serpent if the hatchlings go free?
If I find the young viper, Guthwulf grinned, I will happily grind him beneath my heel.
No,
Elias shouted, startling Guthwulf with his vehemence.
No!
The spy must live, and any of his companions, until we have them here in the Hayholt safe. There are questions we must ask them. Elias, as if embarrassed by his outburst, turned strangely pleading eyes to his old friend. You understand that? Surely?
Of course, Majesty, Guthwulf answered quickly. They need only be brought to us with the breath still quick in their bodies, said Priorates, calm as a baker talking of flour. Then we shall discover everything.
Enough.
Elias slid farther back on his seat of bone. Guthwulf was surprised to see drops of sweat beading his forehead, even as the Earl of Utanit was shivering in the chill air.
Go now, old friend. Bring me Luth's full allegiance. Or if not, I will send you back to bring me his head. Go.
God keep you, Majesty.
Guthwulf dropped off the bench onto one knee, then rose to his feet and back down the aisle. The banners above his head swung, wind-whipped. In the fluid shadows thrown by the flickering torches, the clan animals and heraldic beasts seemed engaged in an eerie, fitful dance. Guthwulf met Fengbold in the antechamber hall. The Earl of Falshire had bathed the grit of the road from his face and hair since their meeting that morning, and was dressed in a red velvet jerkin with the silver eagle of his family chased on the breast, its feathers twining in a fanciful pattern.
Ho, Guthwulf, have you seen him?
He asked. The Earl of Utanit nodded.
Yes, and you will too. God curse it, he is the one who should be taking salt air at Merrimund instead of Miriamel. He looks... I don't know. He looks damned ill, and the throne chamber is cold as frost.
So, it's true?
Fengbold asked sullenly.
About the princess? I was hoping he'd changed his mind.
Gone west to the sea. Your great day will have to wait a bit, it looks. Guthwulf smirked.
I'm sure you'll find something to keep your interest up until the princess returns. That's not the problem.
The Earl of Falshire's mouth twisted as though he tasted something sour.
I just fear he's trying to back out of his promise. I have heard that nobody knew she was ill until she was gone.
You worry too much, Guthwulf said. It's womanish.
Elias needs an heir.
Be grateful that you fit his bill of particulars for a son-in-law better than I do. Guthwulf showed his teeth in a mocking smile.
I would go to Merrimund and get her.
He gave a mock salute and sauntered away, leaving Fengbold standing before the high oak doors of the throne room. She could tell from far away up the corridor that it was Earl Fengbold, and that he was in a foul temper, his arms swinging walk, like a young boy sent away from the supper table, and the loud, deliberate banging of his boot heels on the floor stones trumpeted his mood before him. She reached forward and tugged at Jael's elbow. When the cow-eyed girl looked up, already sure she'd done something else wrong, Rachel made a gesture toward the approaching Earl of Falshire.
Better move that bucket, girl!
She took the scrubbing broom from Jael's hand. The pail of soapy water stood in the center of the hallway, directly in the path of the oncoming nobleman.
Hurry up, you stupid girl!
Rachel hissed, a touch of alarm tinging her voice. The moment the words were out, Rachel knew she should not have uttered them, Fengbold was cursing to himself, his face set in a petulant snarl. Jael, in a frenzy of ill-coordinated haste, let the bucket slide through her wet fingers. It struck the floor with a loud thump, and a gout of sudsy water slopped over the rim to splatter onto the hallway. Fengbold, upon them now, stepped squarely in the spreading puddle. He lost his balance for a moment, throwing his arms up as he slid, then clutched at a tapestry on the wall for support, as Rachel watched in helpless, anticipatory horror. It was a stroke of luck that the hanging held Fengbold's weight long enough for him to regain his equilibrium. Nonetheless, a moment later the tapestry itself pulled free at an upper corner and slid gently down the wall to sag into the soapy pool. Rachel looked at the Earl of Falshire's reddening face for only a moment before turning to Jael.
Go, you clumsy cow! Get on with you! No!
Jael, with a hopeless glance at Fengbold, turned and ran, her fat rump wagging pitifully.
Come back here, you slut!
Fengbold screamed, jaw trembling with rage. His long black hair, disarranged, hung in his face.
I'll have my due for this...
Rachel, keeping an eye cocked toward the Earl, bent and lifted the sodden corner of the tapestry out of the water. There was no way she could rehang it. She stood holding it, watching it drip as Fengbold raged.
Look! Look at my boots! I'll have that filthy bitch's throat slit for this!
The Earl turned his eye onto Rachel.
How dare you send her away!
Rachel cast her eyes down. Not hard to do since the young nobleman stood at least a foot taller than she.
I'm sorry, Lord, she said,
and her honest fear put a convincing tone of respect into her voice.
She is a stupid girl, Master, and she will be beaten for it. But I am the mistress of chambermaids, and I take the blame, you see. I'm very, very sorry.
Fengbold stared down at her for a moment, and his eyes narrowed. Then, as swiftly as an arrow strikes, he reached out and slapped Rachel across the face. Her hand flew up to the red mark spreading across her cheek, spreading as the puddle had across the flagstones.
Then give that to the fat slut, Fengbold spat. And if I run into her again, you tell her I'll break her neck.
He stared at the mistress of chambermaids for a moment, then walked on down the hall, leaving a trail of heel and toe boot prints shimmering wetly on the flags.
And he could do it too, Rachel thought to herself later, as she sat on her bed holding a wet wash rag to her burning cheek.
Across the hall, in the maid's dormitory, Jael was sobbing. Rachel had not had the heart even to shout at her, but the sight of Rachel's swelling face had been punishment enough to send the lumpy, soft-hearted girl into a paroxysm of tears.
Sweet Riap and Palipa, I'd rather be slapped twice than listen to her blubbering.
Rachel rolled over onto the hard pallet. She kept it on a board because of her always aching back, and pulled the blanket up over her head to dull the sound of Jael's weeping. Wrapped in the blanket, she could feel her own warm breath wreathing her face.
This must be what it's like to be laundry in the basket, she thought,
and then chided herself for such simple-mindedness.
You're getting old, old woman, old and useless.
Suddenly she found tears coming, the first she had cried since the news about Simon.
I'm just so tired. Sometimes I think I'm going to drop where I stand, fall over like a broken broom at the feet of these young monsters, stamping around my castle, treating us like we were dirt. And they'd probably just push me out with the dust. So tired. If only...
The air beneath the blanket was thick and warm. She had finished crying. What good were tears anyway? Leave them to her stupid, flighty girls. And now she felt herself falling into sleep, succumbing to its heaviness as though drowning in warm, sticky water. And in her dream, Simon was not dead, had not died in the terrible fire that had also taken Morghenes, and several of the guardsmen who had rushed to put it out. Even Count Breugar, they said, had perished in the catastrophe, crushed beneath the collapse of the flaming roof. No, Simon was alive and healthy. Something about him was different, but Rachel could not say what. The look in his eye, the harder line of his jaw, but that did not matter. It was Simon, alive. And as she dreamed, Rachel's heart was full again. She saw him, the dead boy, her dead boy, really. Hadn't she raised him like a mother until he was taken away? And he was standing in a place of near absolute whiteness, staring up at a great white tree that stretched into the air like a ladder to the throne of God. And though he stood resolutely, his head flung back and his eyes upon the tree, Rachel could not help noticing that his hair, that thick reddish tangle, was badly in need of cutting. Well, she would see to that soon, right enough. The boy needed a firm hand. When she woke, pulling the smothering blanket aside in a panic to find more darkness around her, this time the darkness of evening, the weight of loss and grief came sliding back down like a wet tapestry. As she sat up on the bed and climbed slowly to her feet, the wash rag tumbled free, dry as an autumn leaf. There was no call for her to be laying about, pining like some fluttery girl child. There was work that needed doing, Rachel reminded herself, and no rest this side of heaven. The table rattled, and the lute player plucked a gentle chord before beginning the last verse. And now dost thou come, my lady fair, in candory cloth and silks withal. Then if thou wouldst rule o'er my heart, take foot now and follow to Emetin's hall. The musician finished with a flurry of delicate notes, then bowed as Duke Leobardus applauded.
Emetin's hall, the duke said to Eolair, Count of Nad Mullach, who followed Leobardus' example with his own dutiful applause.
Secretly, the earnest steerman felt sure that he had heard better. He was not much taken by the love ballads that were so popular here in the Nabonne court.
I am fond of that song, the duke smiled.
His long white hair and pink cheeks gave him the look of a favorite old great-uncle, the sort who drank too much stout at the Aventide feasts, and then tried to teach the children how to whistle. Only the flowing white robe trimmed in lapis and gold, and the golden circlet on his head with its mother-of-pearl kingfisher, proclaimed him as different than ordinary men.
Come, Count Eolair, I thought that music was the lifeblood of the Teig. Does not Luth count himself Austin Ard's greatest patron of harpers, and your Hernes dear the natural home of musicians?
The duke leaned across the arm of his sky-blue chair to pat Eolair's hand.
King Luth does indeed keep his harpers beside him at all times, Eolair agreed. Please, Duke, if I seem preoccupied, it is in no way due to any stinting on your part. Your kindness had been indeed a thing to remember. No, I must admit I am still bothered about the matters we discussed earlier. A look of concern came to the Duke's mild blue eyes. I have told you, my Eolair, that there is time for such things. It is very wearing to have to wait, but there you are.
Leobardus motioned to the lute player, who had been waiting patiently on one knee. The musician rose, bowed, and moved off. His fantastically intricate garment flounced around him as he joined a group of courtiers similarly garbed in sumptuously embroidered robes and tunics. The ladies had supplemented their outfits with exotic hats winged like seabirds, or crested like the fins of bright fish. The colors in the throne room, like those of the courtiers' costumes, were muted. Tasteful blues, yellow beiges, pinks, whites, and foam greens. The impression was that of a palace built from delicate sea stones, everything smoothed and softened by the clutch of the ocean. Beyond the gentlemen and ladies of the court, taking up the whole southwest wall facing the duke's chair, were the high-arched windows that looked out over the active, sun-tipped green sea. The ocean, which threw itself ceaselessly against the rocky headland on which the ducal palace perched, was a vibrant living tapestry. Watching through the day as the moving light danced on its surface, or revealed patches of still sea as heavy and translucent as jade, Eolef frequently wished to sweep the courtiers from the way, send them tumbling and squeaking from the room so that nothing would obscure his view.
"Perhaps you are right, Duke Cleobardis," Eole said at last. "One must stop talking sometime, even when the subject is a vital one. I suppose sitting here I should be taking a lesson from the ocean. It doesn't need to work hard to get what it wants. Eventually it wears the rock away, the beaches, even the mountains."
Cleobardis liked this sort of conversation better.
"Ah, yes, the sea never changes, does it? And yet, it is always changing."
"That's true, my lord. And it is not always quiet. Sometimes there are storms."
As the Duke cocked his head toward the Hernest steerman, unsure whether this remark meant something more than was immediately obvious, his son Benigaris strode into the room, nodding briefly to some of the courtiers who greeted him as he moved toward the Duke's chair.
"The Duke, my father, Count Eolair," he said, bowing once to each.
Eolair smiled and put out a hand to clasp Benigaris.
"It's good to see you," the Hernesteerman said. Benigaris was taller than when he had last seen him, but the Duke's son had then been only 17 or 18.
Nearly 2 decades had passed, and Eolair was not displeased to see that despite his being a good 8 years the elder, it was Benigaris who had thickened around the waist. Not he. Nonetheless, the Duke's son was tall and broad-shouldered, with intent dark eyes beneath thick black brows. He made quite an imposing figure in his belted tunic and quilted vest, an energetic contrast to his affable father.
"Yeah, it has been a long time," Benigaris agreed. "We shall talk at supper tonight."
Eolair did not think he sounded very excited at the prospect. Benigaris turned to his father.
"Sir Florian is here to see you. He is with the Chamberlain at the moment."
"Ah, good old Florian. There is irony for you, Eolair. One of the greatest knights Naban has ever produced."
"Only your brother Camaris was ever called greater,"
Eolair interrupted, not adverse to resurrecting the memories of a more martial Naban.
"Yes, my dear brother."
Leobardis smiled a sad smile.
"Well, to think that Florian should be coming to see me as an emissary of Elias."
"There is a certain irony,"
Eolair said lightly. Benigaris curled his lip with impatience.
"He's waiting for you. I think you should see him quickly, as a gesture of respect to the High King."
"My, my,"
Leobardis turned an amused glance toward Eolair.
"Do you hear my son order me?"
When the Duke turned back to Benigaris, Eolair thought there might be something in Leobardis' gaze beside amusement. Anger? Worry?
"Yes, then tell my old friend, Florian, I will see him. Let me think. Yes, in the council hall. Will you join us, Eolair?"
Benigaris leaped in.
"Father, I do not think you should invite even so trusted a friend as the Count in to hear secret communications from the High King."
"And what need, may I ask, is there for secrets to be kept from Hernesteer?"
the Duke asked. Anger had crept into his voice. "Please, Leobardis, I have things I must do anyway. I shall walk in later to say hello to Florian." Eolair rose and bowed. As he stopped on his way across the throne room to look one more time on the splendid view, he heard the voices of Leobardis and his son raised behind him in muffled argument.
"Waves make more waves, as these Nabonae say," thought Eolair. "It looks as though Leobardis' balance is more delicate than I thought. Doubtless that is why he is so unwilling to talk frankly with me about his troubles with the king. A good thing it is that Leobardis is a tougher stalk than he appears to be."
He heard the courtiers whispering behind him, and turned to see several of them looking in his direction. He smiled and nodded. The women blushed, covering their mouths with their flowing sleeves. The men nodded gravely and quickly looked away. He knew what they were thinking. He was a curiosity, a rustic and untutored Westerner, even if he was an old friend of the Duke's. No matter what he wore or how perfectly he spoke, still they would feel the same. Suddenly, Eolaire felt a deep longing for his home in Hernesteer. He had been too long in foreign courts. The waves rushed against the rocks below, as though the sea would not be satisfied until its monstrous patience had at last brought the palace tumbling down into its watery grasp. Eolaire spent the rest of the afternoon strolling the high, airy hallways and meticulous gardens of the Sankelen Magistravis. Although it was now the Duke's palace and the capital of Navan, once it had been the seat of man's whole empire in Ostenard. Diminished in importance now, still its glories were many. Perched on the rocky knob of the Sankelein Hill, the palace's western walls overlooked the sea, which had always been Navan's lifeblood. Indeed, all of Navan's noble houses used waterbirds as the symbols of their power. The Benny Dryvine kingfisher of the current Duke's line, the Praven Osprey, and Ingadarine albatross. Even the heron of Sulis that had once briefly flown over the Hayholt in Erkinland. East of the palace, the city of Navan itself spread down the peninsula's neck, a crowded, swarming city of hills and close quarters, thinning at last as the peninsula widened out into the meadows and farms of the lakeland. From the known world to this peninsular duchy and bridal veil of island possessions, Navan's vistas had narrowed, and its rulers had turned in on themselves. But once, not too long ago, the mantle of the Nabonae Imperators had covered the world, from the brackish Ran to the farthest reaches of icy Rimmersgard. In those days, the wrangling of osprey and pelican, and the strivings of heron and gull, had carried as their reward a prize worth any risk. Eolaire walked in the Hall of Fountains, where jets of glimmering spray arched up to commingle as fine mist beneath the open latticework of the stone roof, and wondered if there was yet the will left in the Nabonae to fight, or whether they had simply come to terms with their own gradual diminution, so that Elias' provocations only served to drive them further into their beautiful, delicate shell. Where now were the men of greatness, like those who had carved Navan's empire out of the rough stone of Ostenard, men like Tiagaris or Anitulis? Of course, he thought, there was Camaris, a man who, had he not found in himself a stronger call to serve than to be served, might have held the willing world in the palm of his hand. Camaris had been a mighty man indeed. And who are we Hernesteermen to speak, he wondered, since Herne the Great? What mighty men have risen up in our western lands? Death Tane, who took the Hayholt from Sulis, perhaps, but who else? Where is Hernesteer's Hall of Fountains? Where are our great palaces and churches? But of course, that is the difference. He looked out past the streaming fountains to the cathedral spire of the Sankelen Adonitis, the palace of the Lector and Mother Church. We of the Hernesteri do not look at the hill streams and say, how can I bring that to my home? We build our homes beside the stream. We do not have a faceless god to glorify with towers taller than the trees of the Kirkcoil. We know that the gods live in the trees and in the bones of the earth, and in the rivers that splash high as any fountain, racing down from the Green Spoke Mountains. We never wanted to rule the world. He smiled to himself, remembering the Teig at Ernisadark, a castle made not of stone but wood, oak-hearted to match the hearts of his people. Really now all we want is to be left alone. Still, with all their years of conquest, perhaps these Navan folk have forgotten sometimes you have to fight for that, too. As he left the Room of Fountains, Eolair of Nad Mullach brushed past two Legion guardsmen coming in.
"Bloody hillman,"
he heard one of them say, eyeing his garb and horsetail of black hair.
"Yeah, you know," the other replied. "Every now and then the sheepherders need to come and see what the city looks like."
"And how is my little niece Miriam Mel, Count?" the Duchess asked.
Eolair was seated at her left hand near the head of the long table. Fluoren, as a more recent arrival, and a distinguished son of Naban, had the place of honour on the right of Duke Leobardis.
"She seemed well, my lady."
"Did you see much of her while you were at the High King's Court?"
The Duchess Nessalanta leaned toward him, raising an exquisitely drawn eyebrow. The Duchess was a sternly beautiful older woman. Although how much of that beauty was due to the skilled manipulations of her hairdressers, seamstresses, and ladies' maids, Eolair had no way of guessing. Nessalanta was exactly the kind of woman who made Eolair, no stranger to the company of the fairer sex, feel completely out of his depth. She was younger than her husband, the Duke, but she was the mother of a man well into his prime. What here was lasting beauty, and what was artifice? Then again, what did it matter? Nessalanta was a powerful woman, and only Leobardis himself held greater sway over the affairs of the nation.
"I was not often in the princess' company, Duchess, but we had several chances to speak at supper. She was as delightful as ever, but I'm thinking she was already very homesick for Merrimond."
"Hmm,"
the Duchess popped a corner of her trencher bread into her mouth, and then delicately licked her fingers.
"It was interesting you should mention that, Count Eolair. I have just had news from Erkinland that she has returned to the castle at Merrimond."
She raised her voice.
"Father Denivan."
A few seats down, a young priest looked up from his meal, although his scalp was shaved in a monasterial style. The hair that remained was curly and rather long.
"Yes, my lady," he asked. "Father Denivan is His Sacredness the Lector in Essen's private secretary,"
Nessalanta explained. The Hernesteerman made an impressed face, and Denivan laughed.
"I don't think it's accreditable to any great wit or talent on my part," he said. "The Lector also takes in stray dogs. Escritor Veligis gets very upset. The Sancalonidonitis is not a kennel," he tells the Lector. "But His Sacredness smiles and says, neither is Austin Ard a nursery. But the benevolent Lord lets his children remain for all their mischief."
Denivan waggled his bushy brows.
"It's hard to argue with the Lector."
"Isn't it true?"
the Duchess said as Eolair laughed.
"That when you saw the king, he said his daughter was gone to Merrimond?" "Yes, yes, he did," Denivan said, more serious now. "He said she had taken ill, and the court physicians recommended sea air."
"I am sorry to hear that."
Eolair looked past the Duchess to the Duke and old Sir Fluoren, who were conversing quietly amidst the uproar of supper. For a refined people, he reflected, the Nabonese certainly enjoyed loud table talk.
"Well,"
Nessalanta pronounced, sitting back in her chair as a page scurried up with a finger basin,
"it just proves that you can't force people to be what they're not. Miriamel has Nabonese blood, of course, and our blood is salty as the sea. We are not meant to be taken away from the coast. People should stay where they belong."
"And what," the Count wondered to himself, "are you trying to tell me, my gracious lady? To stay in Hernesteer and leave your husband and your duchy alone? To, in effect, go back to my own kind?" Eolair watched Leobardis and Fluorin's discussion wistfully. He had been maneuvered, he knew. There was no gracious way he could ignore the Duchess and insinuate himself into their conversation. Meanwhile, Old Fleurin was at work on the Duke, transmitting Elias blandishments. And threats? No, probably not. Elias would not have sent the dignified Fleurin for that. He had Gothwulf, the king's hand, ready for use, whenever such a tool was called for. Resigned, he made light talk with the Duchess, but his heart was not in it. He was sure now that she knew his mission and was hostile to it. Bene Gesserit was the apple of her eye, and he had been avoiding Eolair all evening. Nessalenta was an ambitious woman, and doubtless felt the fortunes of Naban would be better assured if they were yoked to the power of Erkinland, even a domineering, tyrannical Erkinland, instead of the pagans of Hernestia. And, Eolair realized suddenly, she has a marriageable daughter herself, the Lady Antipa. Perhaps her interest in Miriamel's health is not just that of her kindly aunts for her niece. The Duke's daughter Antipa was pledged already, he knew, to one Baron de Vasselis, a foppish-looking young nobleman who at this precise moment was arm-wrestling with Bene Gesserit in a pool of wine at the far end of the table. But maybe Nessalanta had her eye on greater things. If Princess Miriamel will not or cannot marry, Eolair mused, then perhaps the Duchess has eyes for Fengbald to marry her daughter instead. The Earl of Falchia would be a much finer catch than any back-row Nabonne baron, and Duke Leobardus would then be tied to Erkinland with cords of steel. So now, the Count realized, there was not only Joshua's whereabouts to worry over, but Miriamel's as well. What a tangle! Just think how old Iskrimnor would see this, with all his complaints about intriguing. His beard would catch fire. Tell me, Father Denevan, the Count said, turning to the priest, what does your holy book have to say on the art of politicking? Well, a look of concentration momentarily clouded Denevan's homely, intelligent face. The Book of the Aedan speaks often of the trials of nations. He thought a moment more. One of my favorite passages has always been, if your enemy comes to speak bearing a sword, open your door to him and speak, but keep your own sword at hand. If he comes to you empty-handed, greet him the same way. But if he comes to you bearing gifts, stand on your walls and cast stones down on him. Denevan wiped his fingers on his black cassock. A wise book indeed, nodded Eolair.
Chapter 23. Back into the Heart.
The wind flung rain into their faces as they ran eastward through the darkness toward the hidden foothills. The clamor of Iskrimnor's camp receded, muffled in a blanket of thunder. Coursing across the wet plain, Simon's panicked exhilaration began to recede as well. The ecstatic sensation of energy, the feeling that he could run and run through the night like a deer, was gradually cooled by the rain and relentless pace. Within half a league, his gallop had slowed to a fast walk. Soon, even that was an effort. Where a bony hand had clutched his knee, he felt the joint stiffening like a rusty hinge. Bands of pain around his throat throbbed at every deep breath.
Morcanes sent you? He shouted.
Later, Simon, Binnabik gasped. All told later.
They ran and ran, tripping and splashing over the sodden turf. Then, Simon panted,
then what were those things?
The attacking things?
Even as he ran, the troll made an odd hand-to-mouth gesture.
Bokan, diggers, they are also called.
What are they?
Simon asked, and nearly slipped on a patch of mud, skidding for a moment flat-footed.
Bad, he grimaced. There is no more needs telling now.
When they could run no longer, they walked, trudging on until the sun edged up behind the wash of clouds, a candle behind a grey sheet. The Wealdhelm stood before them, thrown up in relief against the pallid dawn, like the bowed backs of monks at prayer. In the meager shelter of a cluster of rounded granite boulders, set starkly in the sea of grass, as though in imitation of the hills beyond, Binnebik made a sort of camp. After walking around the rocks to find the spot most sheltered from the shifting rains, he helped Simon down into a space where two boulders leaned together, forming an angle in which the boy could recline with some minimal comfort. Simon fell quickly into limp, exhausted sleep. Flying raindrops skipped from the tops of the boulders as Binnebik crouched, tucking in the boy's cloak, which the troll had brought with their other things all the way from St. Holerun's. Then rooted in his pack for some dried fish to chew, and his knuckle bones. Kantaka returned from an investigatory tour of her new territory to curl up on Simon's shins. The troll took the bones out and tossed them, using his pack bag for a table. The shadowed path. Binnebik grinned a bitter grin. Then, masterless ram, and again, the shadowed path. He cursed, quietly but lengthily. Only a fool would ignore such a clear message. Binnebik knew himself to be many things, and foolish was occasionally one of them, but here, now, there was no room to take such chances. He pulled his fur hood back up around his face and curled in beside Kantaka. To any passing by, if they could have seen anything at all in the faint light, and with rain in their faces, the three companions would have looked like nothing so much as an unusual, dun-colored lichen on the lee side of the rocks.
"So, what kind of a game have you been playing with me, Binnebik?" Simon asked sullenly. "How do you know of Dr. Morgani's?"
In the few hours he had slept, the pale dawn had turned into a cold, gloomy morning, unredeemed by campfire or breakfast. The sky, swollen with clouds, hung close overhead like a low ceiling.
"It is no game I am playing, Simon," the troll replied.
He had cleaned and bandaged Simon's neck and leg wounds, and was patiently seeing to Kantaka's. Only one of the wolf's injuries was serious, a deep slash on the inside of her foreleg. As Binnebik picked grit from the skin, Kantaka sniffed at his fingers, trusting as a child.
"I have no regret for not telling you. If I had not felt forced, still you would not know."
He rubbed a fingerful of salve into the cut, and then turned his mount loose. She promptly bent and began licking and biting at the leg.
"I knew that she would do that," he said in mild reproach,
then mustered a careful smile.
"Like you, she is not thinking. I know my work."
Simon, realizing he had been unconsciously plucking at his own bandages, sat forward.
"Come, Binnebik, just tell me. How do you know of Morgani's? Where do you really come from?"
"I am from exactly where I say," the troll replied indignantly. "I am a Canuck, and I am not merely knowing of Morgani's. Once I met him. He is a good friend of my master. They are colleagues, I think the learned men say."
"What do you mean?"
Binnebik sat back against the rock. Although at the moment there was no rain to shelter from, the cutting wind alone was reason enough to stay close to the outcropping. The little man seemed to be considering his words carefully. He looked tired to Simon, his dark skin loose and a shade paler than normal.
"First," the troll said at last, "you must be knowing something of my master. He was named Ukekuk. He was the singing man, you would call him, of our mountain. When we say singing man, we mean not someone who is just singing, but someone who is remembering the old songs and old wisdom. Like doctor and priest joined together, it seems to me. Ukekuk was my master because of certain things the elders thought they were seeing in me. It was a great honor to be the one to share in Ukekuk's wisdom. I went 3 days without eating food when I was told, just to make myself of the right pureness."
Binnebik smiled.
When I announced this pridefully to my new master, he hit me on my ear. You are too young and stupid to be starving yourself on purpose, he said to me. It has presumptuousness. You may only starve by accident.
Binnebik's grin split open into a laugh. When Simon thought about it for a moment, he laughed a little too.
In any way, he continued, I will be telling you someday about my year's learning from Ooky Cook, who was a great fat troll, Simon. He weighed more than you, and he was being my height only. But now, the point must be reached sooner. I do not know with exactness where my master first met Morghenes, but it was long before I came to his cave. They were friends, though, and my master taught Morghenes the art of making birds carry messages. They had much talk in letters, my master and your doctor. They shared many ideas about the world's ways. Just 2 summers gone, my parents were killed. Their death came in the dragon snow of the mountain we call Little Nose. And once they were no more, I devoted all my thinking, well, almost all, to learning from Master Ooky Cook. When he told me this thaw that I was to be accompanying him on a great journey south, I was filled with excitement. It was clear-seeming to me that this would be my test of worthiness. What I was not knowing,
the troll said, poking up the muddy grass before him with his walking stick. Almost angrily, Simon thought, but there was no anger to hear in his voice.
What I was not told was that Ooky Cook had more important reasons for traveling than the finish of my apprenticeship. He had been receiving words from Dr. Morghenes and some others of things that disturbed him, and he felt it was time to be returning the visit Morghenes had made on him long years before, when I first was with him.
What things? Simon asked. What did Morghenes tell him?
If you are not yet knowing,
Binnebik said, serious,
then perhaps there are still truths you can do without. On that I must think. But for now let me say what I can, what I must.
Simon nodded stiffly, rebuked.
I will not either burden you with all the long story of our southward trip. I was realizing quite early on that my master had not given me all the truth either. He was worried, much worried, and when he cast the bones, or read certain signs in the sky and wind, he became even more so. Also, some of our experiences were very bad. I have traveled by myself, as you know, much of it before becoming a servant of my master Ooky Cook. Yet never have I seen times so bad for travelers. An experience much like yours of last night we were having just below the lake Drosulven on the Frost March.
You mean those Buchen? Simon asked. Even with daylight around them, the thought of the clasping hands was terrifyingly vivid.
Indeed,
Binnebik nodded.
And that was, is, being a bad sign that they should attack so. It is not in the memory of my people that the Borghanic, which is our name for them, should assault a group of armed men. Bold it is, and frighteningly so. Their usual way is to be preying on animals and solitary travelers.
What are they?
Later, Simon, there is much that you will learn if you have patience with me. My master did not tell me all, either, which is not saying, please notice that I am your master, but he was very much upset. In our whole journeying down the Frost March, I did not see him sleeping. When I would sleep, still he would be awake, and the morning would find him up before me. He was not young either. He was old before I came to him, and several years I was by him studying. One night, when first we had crossed down into the northern parts of Arkenland, he asked me to be standing watch so that he could walk the road of dreams. We were in a place much like this.
Benevik gestured around at the bleak plain below the hills.
Spring arrived, but not yet broken through. This would have been, perhaps around the time of your All Fool's Day, or the day before.
All Fool's Eve. Simon tried to think back to remember.
The night that terrible noise awakened the whole castle, the night before the rains came. Kantaka was off hunting, and the old ram, One Eye, a great fat patient thing he was to carry Okekuk, was sleeping by the fire. We were alone, with just the sky. My master ate of the dream bark that came to him from the marshy ran in the south. He crossed over into a kind of sleeping. He had not told me why he was doing this, but I could guess he was searching for answers that he could find no other way. The bog hen ikat frightened him, because there was wrongness in their actions. Soon he was mumbling, as he was usually doing as his heart walked the road of dreams. Much was not understandable, but one or two things that he said were also said more lately by Brother Dog Eyes, which is why you may have seen me show surprise.
Simon.